Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
Live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue on heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen to the show through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Lady Sue, and what do I do when I'm not hosting Word of Mouth? I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear on my show, and working with my clients, which include chefs, somms, big brands, startups, all those doing what's most delicious and innovative. Happy New Year, my first show of the year, and it's not that cold outside, right?
Yeah, well, right.
That was Ken Orange, but he's coming on later. So today's in-studio guest on People We Like will later on welcome Ken Oringer, chef owner of Toro in New York. His Time review just came out on New Year's Eve. 2 stars, and congrats to him. And he's also chef and owner of 5 Boston-area restaurants for you New Yorkers who are very New York-centric and may not know. He's been around for a long time, including Clio, Uni, Tora, Copa, and Earth. And he's also an Iron Chef America and James Beard Award winner. But before that, instead of our usual trip to the Green Market, we'll drop by a new opening just steps away from Union Square, in fact. It's called Alonda. It's French Venetian food. And we'll talk to Chef Chris Jekyll about his New Year's resolutions. We'll zoom back to the studio to catch up with Ken Oringer. Then after that, to wind it down, we'll hear from Ken himself on the trials and tribulations of Chocoli, my favorite Basque beverage. First, let's head to Alonda pre-service to talk about how Chris Jekyll will make 2014 his best year yet.
My New Year's resolution is to compete in 3 centuries this year.
A century
is a 100-mile bike ride.
And you usually do?
I do 1 annually, which is the multiple sclerosis ride. So I have one of my closest friend's mother has MS, so we do that ride together every year. But, you know, I've sort of been, with how busy I am, I've been slacking on my training, so I'm hoping to get 3 done this year.
Excellent. Where are you riding?
The one I do every year is Nyack. So the way I train is I go to the George Washington Bridge into upstate New York through Rockland County, through Nyack, Piedmont, and then back down, Bear Mountain on occasion also. And I have done the North Fork Century, which is flatlands, which is one that I'll probably do this year. And I'm thinking about the Grand Fondo, which is also the Jersey version of it. So you run through the Rockland County, upstate New York, Bear Mountain, and back through and back across the George Washington Bridge.
So is that crazy? Does that feel crazy to ride for, what's the hardest part?
100 hertz. Like 60 or 70 is a good day. You know, you break 70 and you start to be shoulders ache and your back aches and you're running 6 hours on a bicycle. You start to, I'm not physically a large human being, so I don't have the muscle structure in my back and my shoulders necessarily to keep me up. So that gets uncomfortable. But the legs usually feel pretty good.
Okay, so the first moment that you get off the bike after 100...
Really, my ass fucking hurts. I mean, really, that's an honest answer.
No, I wonder, because, do you get off and on, though?
No. That's not true. When I do them, I usually, every 30 miles or so, there's usually a rest stop. So you stop feeding stations, water, so you pull over, you get a peanut butter sandwich or a banana, and refill your water bottles and move on, just keep your energy level going. And then we have the cycling jerseys have pockets in the back, so we usually stuff them full of protein gels and energy gels and that sort of stuff, and that kind of keeps us hydrated and nutrient
filled.
Sure.
What's your food and drink resolution, please.
Drink more whiskey. Is that a resolution?
Why is that?
Because I don't think I drink enough whiskey.
That's such an unusual one.
Well, I mean, I think it's just really honest. This year's been tame for me. I'm getting a little older, so I'm sort of relaxing on that front a little bit. But, you know, energy's high, adrenaline's high. I think maybe get a little more whiskey in me.
Especially to celebrate the opening.
Yes. We've started that, but there's, you know, once the public really happens, we'll be able to really sort of, I don't know if let loose is the right word, but really start to enjoy it.
Welcome back to the studio. I'm your host, Leyte Su, and you're listening to Word of Mouth with yours truly on heritageradionetwork.org. So, that was just Chris Jekyll, chef at Alonda, just opened. If you like that, go to heritageradionetwork.org and search resolutions for the post-produced piece to hear from others like Laura Manick, master sommelier and owner at Cork Buzz, and Jeff Taylor, head sommelier of 11 Madison Park. Plus, next week, same time, Tuesday, 10 a.m., live in the studio, I'll have Chris's partner, also named Chris, Chris Cannon, that is, on Word of Mouth here in the studio. So, some social media info before we get started with Ken here. As always, hashtag WOMSHOW, that's WOMSHOW for Word of Mouth, at Heritage_Radio, at Leyte Su, LEITIHSU, at Ken Oringer, that's KENOORINGER, and at Toro NYC, TORONYC. And now, for people we like. Welcome, Ken.
Is that you singing?
I wish.
That's incredible.
It's actually Lisa Maisie. She's she's a friend of mine. She actually works at Reset. And she is also an opera singer. So I really, as you can probably tell from knowing me, I love people who are multi-talented.
She's incredible.
I know. She's pro. She performed in San Francisco recently. So thank you so much for joining me on and braving the vortex.
A little chilly out there today.
It's not so bad. It's just my hands were starting to turn red on the way here. I'm not sure what that means.
Come on. I have like 8 layers on in the studio right now.
So I missed you at Alex Dupac's holiday party yesterday.
Yeah, I heard it was a pretty fun one.
I like never danced for such a long time and so intensely in a restaurant.
Was Alex DJing at all or no?
Alex brought out some moves.
Oh, his moves are legendary. We went to London once to eat at the Fat Duck when we worked together.
Ooh.
And then he brought me to a drum and bass club. And this was a long, long time ago. And he pulled out the moves. I was like, holy shit, Alex. Didn't know you can do it. You know, he was probably like a 22-year-old kid back then or something like that. But he can move.
He's one of many who have studied under you, and then you've sent them off to become their own successful chefs and restaurateurs in their own right. I was wondering who learned from whom, because, you know, he had an incredible DJ Diesel Boy.
Well, he's legendary also.
And you have here, we're welcoming, you came with an entourage. We have Alana from Baltz, and she says she will not participate, but I wanted to shout her out, Alana Alperstein. And then we also have your nephew, we're going to shout him out.
Matt Galley.
Okay, so.
In the house.
So
teaching him the ins and outs of the restaurant business while he's on holiday break from JMU.
So he's like seriously gonna work in the kitchen with you?
He started yesterday, just, you know, about a short day in our business, a 12-hour, you know, prep shift, and just want to teach him about the camaraderie and just the commitment that people have in a kitchen, the teamwork, and you know, it's something that a lot of people really don't understand. Again, the behind the scenes, everyone thinks that, you know, it's easy to just cook and to be on the other side of a restaurant, and when you're, you know, an 18-year-old kid, to be able to be in a kitchen, because he loves food, but to be able to see again, the little individuals that are doing the tasks every day to really make it happen. It's, you know, it's my opinion. If, when I was that age, that's all I wanted to do.
So, okay, so what tasks did you put him up to? Did you have to cut the carrots into the little tiny cubes yet?
Not yet. We're still teaching him how to use a knife. He almost cut his thumb off yesterday. My sister would have killed me if that happened. But, you know, he peeled a shitload of black garlic, you know, just a lot of organizing things, and lots of onions and corn. We sell, you know, about 100 orders of corn a night. He must have cleaned about 200 ears of corn yesterday. And so just little things. Then we moved him up to the plancha bar and, you know, taught him a little bit. He plated a couple of foie gras and probably one of his favorite foods and things like that. So he's like my best science experiment. He was like 3 years old, and I started taking him out to eat, and eating duck tongues and sea urchin and all things like that. And I still remember stories my sister used to tell me when his friend's parents would take him out to Chinese restaurants when he was like 10 years old, and they'd be getting, you know, beef and broccoli and, you know, like chicken and vegetables.
Orange chicken.
And he would be getting a clay pot of Dungeness crab. And
nice.
That would cost him like, you know, $35 an order and things like
He's
that.
He's like, so, I'm going to get the most expensive thing on the menu.
I don't think he went for the most expensive, but, you know, he went for something that sounded interesting. And, you know, that's the way it should be.
I'm so proud of him. At an early age, we saw there was hope.
But, you know, dating women, I'm sure it's going to be interesting. If he's, you know, take somebody out to eat Dungeness crab and they want like White Castle burgers, you know, it might be a problem. But
okay, so just you know, from a career mentorship and also from a you know, big pimpin' perspective, you can refer him to me when he's ready to date for real, because I feel like in my
world, you like the younger man?
No, I have like a whole gaggle.
I thought you were like
a gaggle
going really young. Okay.
A gaggle of gorgeous food loving women.
Send them my way.
So your kids are also food loving.
Yeah, they're again, they're experiments in the making. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a daughter who's 5 and a son who's 2, and always like to expose everything to them. I mean, I'm not the, you know, chicken finger type of guy, and my wife definitely. You know.
Call them fingers? That sounds real grotesque. I mean, they're just claws. I mean, chicken feet.
No, I'm talking like fried chicken fingers.
Oh, chicken fingers.
Yeah.
Oh, here I am. Sorry, I like grew up on...
Spoken like a true Asian. I like that.
I'm completely dim sum-y. Okay. That's hilarious. So, yeah, so you're not a chicken... Okay, so you don't sort of deign to the kitty palates.
Actually, it's funny. I brought them to one of my favorite places, N Japanese Brasserie, a couple weeks ago. And little hidden gem, which I absolutely love it. And we went for brunch, and they both love œuf à la coque and, you know, like the runny egg yolks and things like that. So we got them some chicken karayage, which is a Japanese fried chicken, and some fried eggs that they can... And
great pronunciation, by the way.
And they're like, well, what do we do with this? I said, you take the chicken and you dip it into the egg yolk and you use that as toast. And like my 2 kids were, you know, just like going to town with that. And then, you know, my son started eating all the salmon eggs out of, I got some, you know, soba noodles with ikura and uni. And he was eating the salmon eggs like they were the coolest thing he's ever seen in his life, just popping them in his mouth like they were candy. And he couldn't believe how you can just press on these things in your mouth and they popped. And,
That was his first time having ikura?
His first, yeah.
Oh, my
He's only 2.
Gosh.
Come on, give him a chance.
Oh, he's 2. Okay. wait, what's his name and what's her name?
His name's Luca, and my daughter's name is Verben.
So Verben has a special meaning.
It's lemon verbena in French, which is my favorite herb.
So Luca got the short end of the... I mean, what does Luca mean?
Well, you know, you don't want to just name somebody after something. I mean, just first of all, it's not... She's older, so it's just something that kind of happened, and I didn't want to have the theme. You know, we're not
that
like
that.
That
would just be a little... Yeah. Get a little, like, cheesy, right?
Yeah.
So why did you... Why New York City? You know, there's so many chefs who do great things all over the world, and New Yorkers can tend to be very self-centered, as I will admit. And we were very excited to have you come, and what was the impetus?
It's just I was with Jamie, my chef and business partner, and we want to expand Toro, Boston, we felt, was starting to get a little bit small for a second one. It was just kind of on the edge. And some friends of ours found this really cool space, pretty much on the West Side Highway in 15th. And we walked through, and it was so dramatic. It was vacant for about 40 years. And we both walked out of there, and we looked at each other. We're like, wow, this is a cool-ass space. And then we looked at each other and said, let's do a Toro here. And it took a while to kind of get, you know, all the paperwork done and all that other nonsense, which always happens in construction. But, you know, we're finally here. We're about a little over 4 months old, and, you know, super psyched that that we're doing it. We're having a, you know, a lot of fun, and we have a huge kitchen and more space than we've ever had to deal with, but, you know, we love it.
So, okay, so congrats on the review that came out on New Year's Eve. That, like, must make
That was tough, you know.
Make most years.
On New Year's Eve, we get a two-star review where we're like, all you want to do is party and celebrate with the staff, and, you know, we are super pumped, and we are, like, just, like, beyond ecstatic, and we're like, holy shit, we have to focus, we have to feed, like, you know, we have to feed, like, 400 people tonight. And all you
they
want
totally
to do
did that
is,
on purpose, by the way.
All you want to do is just you know, party with the staff and, you know, and just have some fun. But believe me, it was the fastest service we've ever had, and everybody was just on cloud nine, and it was just amazing night. And you know, and then obviously went well into the evening with lots of shots and lots of Perones of cava and
nice.
Champagne, and it was great.
Must have been like a really magical service.
Oh, it definitely was.
Yeah.
It definitely was.
So what time did you, like, how do you, now that you've been reviewed so many times, but, you know, you've been awarded and reviewed and you've been through the cycle, and what's your process? Like, do you hear that it's out, someone tells you, or then you check, or then you start reading down and then the stars at the bottom? Like, how did you?
It's funny because, that's the weird thing. Like, back in the day, you used to have to wait for the newspaper, obviously. And that's, you know, that's kind of, I'm old school, I'm used to that. But now, you know, you just have to wait until it goes up online. And we were refreshing our button, like, every minute, you know, looking for it. And we didn't expect it to go live until, you know, about 4 or 5 or something like that. And
but I'm sure everyone at the time is ready to go home for the holidays. So that's why.
Probably.
They put in the hopper.
And then we just kept refreshing. And then finally, actually, Alana gave us a call and said, it's up. And, you know, it said, it's great. It's 2 stars. And
oh, so she broke the news before you had
she
to
broke the news
read and, the lead and then read the second paragraph.
Yeah, she, you know, I think she caught us between the 30 seconds of refreshing. And then, we just ran to a restaurant and, you know, Jamie sabered a bottle of champagne and, you know, and then we just passed around a couple Perones and, you know, gave some thank you speeches and all that stuff. And then it was right back to business. But everybody, again, had smiles on their face like you could never imagine. And, again, just headaches from just having a smile for, like, you know, 8 hours straight. You know, it's like doing a modeling photo shoot or something like this.
Clearly, so your thing.
Oh, yeah.
So, at what point, like, in your career did you get, and I think this is important for your nephew to hear, where, like, when you pursue something that you totally love and you're great at it, at some point, and then you realize that you might be great at it, and then you start to believe that you are great at it, and that you, if you just keep on working hard, that, you know, amazing things will happen. Like, was there a point where you're like, wow, I'm so excited.
You know, chefs are, you know, so stubborn and they're a pain in the ass. I mean, they always think they're great probably from the first day they pick up a knife. But, but you know, it's just something that all the hard work and, you know, I don't know when, believe me, I don't even consider myself good half the days that I work. But it's just, again, a matter of just cooking things to your palate and getting people to believe in what you do and getting people to, you know, just to take pride in, everybody take pride in the consistency and in one vision and one culture. So in terms of great, you know, it's not a word I would ever use to describe probably anything that I've ever made, except maybe some things I make for my kids. But, you know, I think just to be successful and to be really good at something that you do, it just kind of, it's just never giving up and never being satisfied and just pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. But, you know, critically, I think, you know, from reviews and things like that, I mean, it's one person's opinion.
Yep.
So you can't take them too seriously, believe me. I mean, the New York Times is as good as it gets. But, you know, you still have to cook for every single person in the restaurant. You can get a 4-star review and have 10 people complain that night. And, you know, and a year later, you know, you're out of business. So the stars, you know, when push comes to shove, really don't matter, because it's a matter of just cooking the best food you possibly can cook for every guest and paying attention to what's happening in your restaurant.
What about when, you know, you had your first restaurant, Cleo, and then you had some surprise guests?
Yeah, Cleo, you know, Cleo is pretty funny because we're like 17 years old now, and we've been around for a long time. But, you know, sometimes you just open a restaurant and mm-hmm. you never know what's going to happen. I mean, right. I'm always nervous about even people coming in the doors the first night that you open. And people, even in New York, I was like, holy shit, are anybody going to come in? We have a big restaurant here. Who the hell is going to come into the West Side Highway?
It's huge and beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful restaurants in New York.
And you never know. So luckily, again, in these days, you know, we have an amazing PR company, and, you know, Alana and Baltz, you know, help get the word out and things like that. But back in those days, you know, we didn't have a PR company or anything. So you're wondering how people are going to hear about the restaurant,
it's
how
like
people are going to come out.
Throwing a party, and then it's like, it starts at 7, and at 7:15, you're like, is anyone my friend?
And then you're like, holy shit, we have too much tequila, we're going to have to drink all this. But it was pretty cool because after being open for about 2 months, I had a general manager who was from Provence, and, you know, we were just like cooking, and, you know, we were luckily, you know, busy from day one, and but we were just cooking, and it was just like five guys in the kitchen, and that was it. And, you know, we were just doing our thing, just trying to get better and better, and, you know, just trying to speak our vision about food. And then my GM comes in, Christian, and he's mm-hmm. like, Oh my God, you will not believe who's here. And I was like, tell me, who's here? And, you know, it was almost like Ratatouille a little bit, you know, but it wasn't a food critic. It was Roger Verger, who was a very famous at that time, like from the Bocuse days, a very famous 3-star Michelin chef from Provence. And it was like, wow, it's like, how the hell would this guy ever hear about us in Boston? You know, New York is a different story. Everybody comes to New York. But in Boston, it's a little bit out of the way, and you kind of have to go there for a reason or something like that. But it was so cool to actually be cooking for a 3-star Michelin, you know, chef that, you know, found us out of nowhere, being open just a few months. And I was really, really, really nervous. I mean, I'd never had to cook for anybody, you know, like that before. I mean, I'd never cooked for a 3-star Michelin chef before. That'd be like Robuchon, you know, or Bocuse, or one of those guys walking into a restaurant. I mean, it's definitely a little nerve-wracking. But that's when, you know, we started thinking, like, wow, maybe the food that we're cooking is really starting to, you know, get some attention, because it was a pretty humbling experience cooking for somebody like that. Nervous as hell, but...
What, like, you know, there's a thing about chefs cooking for chefs. It's almost like, it's like the scariest kind
of... You have no idea. I cooked
I don't have any idea, actually.
For Danielle. I still remember cooking for Danielle and Thomas Keller at Cleo once, and I threw up both times after.
What?
It was just so exhausting. You know, at the end of the meal, I was like, oh my God, it's so draining.
You
like,
threw up?
You know, yeah, I was like so like nervous and relieved, and just like, holy, I was like, wow. And then, you know, and then Farron Adria came in a couple times over the years and people like that. And, you know, still, you know, to this day, you know, you definitely get nervous, and, you know, who knows? I mean, if Ferran came to, you know, Toro, New York tonight, you know, I wouldn't be the most relaxed guy, like you sitting in your chair right there.
You're getting a little better at it, though, right now.
A little bit.
Experience and some seasoning.
And confidence, yeah.
So we're going to cut to a very quick commercial break, and when we're back, we'll talk to Ken about his inspiration from some greats: Jack Papin, David Burke, Jean Georges.
You are listening to Tom Cruise on Word of Mouth with ATC, only on the Heritage Radio Network.org. Thank you.
International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Welcome back to the studio. We're here with Ken Oringer, chef owner of Toro, after his big review in the Times, and catching up on life and food and everything important. So, Ken, if you were to have done a dream job other than become a chef, what would that have been?
Let's see. I love music, always have. So I think everybody probably would want to be in a band at some point of their life.
What kind of band?
I'd say ska would be pretty cool. just because it's a little
That's
bit different.
Basque, isn't it?
Ska?
Yeah.
I don't know about that, but ska band would be fun. And then architecture is something that really interests me. I try to get involved in all the designs of all the restaurants that we've done, and it's something that very passionate about. So who knows, maybe one day when I'm done cooking, could go into that or something like that.
Who does the playlist at Toro?
Playlist at Toro, actually, it's funny because my wife does the playlist for most of the restaurants, and she did the opening playlist for Toro. But now it's something that it's a long service. I mean, we're open pretty much from 5 o'clock until 2 o'clock sometimes. So you get tired of the music after a while, and it's pretty much a full-time job to be able to keep up with that. So now it's constantly a debate about what we're going to do about music, and thank God for Pandora now and things like that that we can mix into the shuffle.
Interesting. Want to quickly plug that amazing private party space, private dining room, and sort of a bar space.
Yeah, we have a really cool private dining room, and actually we just opened it up as a bar also on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights from like 11 till like 4 a.m. And it's called Back Bar.
It's called Back Bar, okay.
Yeah.
Didn't have a name the last time I popped my head.
Well, that's what we're calling it this week, but
cool.
Who knows. We've called it the Perron Room. We've called it
Perron
Back Bar.
Room.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm kind of into the...
Have you done the Perron at the restaurant yet?
I haven't.
Oh, come on, Leti. What are you doing?
Oh, man.
You drink all this fancy stuff out of glasses. You got to drink the Perron sometime.
Remind me to bring my bib.
All right. Well, if you drink, cava or, whites, you don't need a bib. You'll be fine.
Let's get some of those meatpacking gals to do that. Like, last time I sat at the beautiful chefy table, then some, gals who look like they're on their way to the club came in. So I think this is certainly a place that can please all palates and,
Hopefully it pleases everybody from grandma to, little kids, and people just keep coming and coming and coming.
Yeah. Your menu is humongous. It's
like the Cheesecake Factory.
It's actually hilariously humongous, and you sort of did it on purpose but sort of didn't. Or you just couldn't help yourself.
It's funny because Jamie and I both love big menus, and we just like so many dishes. It's hard to sometimes limit it. And, sometimes you can say, okay, well, we should have a smaller menu because we can make the food more consistent and it's easier on the stations and it's less work for everybody. But, then we start looking at menus and we're like, oh, man, it would be great to have a dish with, duck tongues. And, oh, it'd be great to have carabineros on the menu. And then it'll be great to have sea cucumber. And then it'll be great to have, we forgot to put a tripe dish on the menu. Oh, we forgot, we need more vegetable dishes. We need a couple more salads. And then we just keep going and going and going. And then we'll start looking at it and say, well, this dish is too good to take off. No, I love this dish. And Jamie would be like, well, this dish is great. And then we'll say, okay, let's shorten the menu. And then we end up taking off like two dishes. And then the next day we'll add five more on because we have some more ideas that pop into our heads. But now we like big menus. And it's, it can be overwhelming at times, but it can also bring a lot of people back in more often, which is something that, we like to do, where people will look at a menu and say, oh, shit, I didn't see the bone marrow on the menu. I didn't see there was foie gras. I didn't see, that there was a huge ribeye, 40-day, aged prime beef from Pat LaFrieda. And so then people will look at the menu and say, okay, you know, they'll start already thinking about things that they want to eat the next time they come in. And I think that's, you know, part of the strategy that we have.
That's one way to do it.
You always want people to want to come back. And then you can have the dishes on there that they'll crave that will bring them back also. So it's a combination of the two.
Yeah, when I was, it's like in size 10 font. And I remember thinking, wow, there must be an army underneath us or hidden somewhere. Yeah.
An army of about 8.
Oh, that's incredible.
We'd love to have an army. If anybody wants to come work, come see us, guys.
Hey, I have this, it's funny, I have this fellow coming to stay with me, for an Airbnb fellow, and he's actually, I'll send him over to you. He's stodging at ASCA, and then, you know, I'll tell him.
Send him over.
Yeah, I'm just funneling resources. You know, you must have you got now restaurants of all cuisines, and now in 2 cities, and who knows what's next. Operationally, and plus I met Zach, who's like a smart cookie, your GM. Mm-hmm. Operationally, you must have it down, you know?
Well, we don't have it down. We're trying to build that infrastructure now, but we have some amazing, amazing people. I mean, Caitlin does an incredible job with the beverage program. Mm-hmm. The wine list is second to none. It's so eclectic and interesting and affordable, and you know, and Zach is awesome, and you know, our sous chefs, we have incredible sous chefs, and you know, we're just trying to learn who we are and what we're doing in our space. And again, we're still new, so our infrastructure is we're just figuring it out every day.
So one ops tip for other chef restaurateurs out there, you know, what's been like a big learning for you as you've, you know, it's like 1, then 2, then 3, then 4, then 5 restaurants. Oh, my God, now New York and a really massive space.
It's just not to be overwhelmed. I mean, okay. I think a lot of chefs now, you know, even like the Alex Stupaks and other guys, I think back in the day, everybody would push so much for so much perfection in one space. And now I think people are realizing that they can stretch their voice a little bit easier and, you know, and still have that drive for perfection, but just bringing in a team that can do a lot more things. I mean, believe me, I never would let go of anything for years and years and years. I would have to do everything and control everything and do everything personally myself. But, you know, you can only grow by growing with others. And I think once you are willing to let go of the reins a little bit, and communication is obviously the key, where you can have your vision understood by more people and interact. And, you know, even over here, just, you know, seeing the staff at Roberta's having a meeting.
Yeah, they're having a lot of people.
Like 100 staff. It just like boggles my mind. It's like, it's crazy how many people work here. And I love it that, you know, all these people in one room listening to, you know, to people talking about what they want to get done. I mean, I just love that, you know, how they're conveying that passion and that message.
Love it. So you also, you know, worked on teams under such incredible culinary talents. But first, before we get to talking about David Burke and Jean-Georges, as a kid, you were like a kind of an odd kid, right?
What do you mean, odd kid? I thought I was a great kid.
You were just a real
odd. You talked to my
mom
this morning?
Yeah, I talked to your mom this morning, and she told me about how you used to cook out of Jacques Pepin's cookbooks.
Yeah, I mean, I was definitely, I wouldn't call myself an odd kid. I thought I was a cool kid, but no, but I loved food at a young age. I was like probably 6 or 8 years old, knew I wanted to be a chef, and luckily my parents encouraged it, and I would just read cookbooks religiously, and, you know, not that I could read, but I would just kind of like glance through them when I was like 6 years old or whatever. But
wow.
But I would glance through them, and I would watch TV shows and Julia Child and all those type of things that were on back then. And this is pre Food Network. And then just kind of thumb through Jacques Pepin's La Méthode, La Technique. And Jacques, you could learn everything about how to skin a rabbit, to how to make consommé, to how to make cream puff swans, to how to make a genoise, to how to make stocks, onion soup, gratiné, you know, all that type of stuff. So literally, I think every page in that book, I cooked something from, you know, over a period of probably about, you know, 5 or 6 years. And, you know, and then when I was in, you know, started high school, I was finally able to start working in restaurants. And, you know, because then all I wanted to do was cook, and I wanted to work in restaurants, but I wasn't old enough. So I would just every weekend and, you know, every night just kind of experiment. And, you know, I was a pain in the ass. You know, I would take my parents, you know, to they'd be like, okay, where do you want to go eat? And I'd be like, oh, I want to go to Chinatown, or I want to go eat ribs in Harlem, and I want to go do this and that. And, you know, and then my mom would cook, and my brother and I would say, oh, you know, pass the, this needs Italian seasoning, this needs cumin. And, you know, and, you know, my mom was working, you know, when we were kids, and, you know, she didn't have a lot of time to cook. And, you know, and she was doing her best. To, we were like, oh, well, we could make this better, and we could do this better. And so, you know, we were really pain in the ass thinking that we knew everything. But they encouraged, you know, my parents encouraged us to just keep eating and, you know, and cooking. And just, you know, it's just we would always, you know, we didn't go to fancy restaurants, but, you know, we loved food.
Yeah, she was like, what? These monsters came out of me.
And I have a twin brother. I mean, we were monsters.
Oh, what does he do?
He's a banker, actually.
Oh, my
gosh. He wishes
he
could be working in restaurants also, I'm sure. He loves... I bring him to do events with me, you know, once in a while, and, you know, he loves it.
Wait, you guys identical?
Fraternal.
Okay. This is... didn't know there was
and he lives in Austin, Texas, another great food town.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Before like, we'll wait in line for hours to eat, you know, Franklin Barbecue and things like that over there.
Great oh, my food. Gosh. Didn't know there was another one of yous. Okay, so... What did you learn from working with David Burke and John George?
Well, when I worked with David Burke, it was when he was at the River Cafe. He was probably, you know, like 30 years old at the time, not even. And he was just, like, driven like no one's business. I mean, it was a busy, busy restaurant. You know, we used to do, like, I don't know, probably like 250, 300 covers, prefix every night, you know, tasting menus, like, you know, 14-course tasting menus. And the menu, a lot of it would change every day. And David would just not stop at anything to be creative. And again, this was a long time ago. I mean, this was 1987. And, you know, Thomas Keller was cooking, you know, in a restaurant. Well, it's still there, Raquel, back at that time. And, you know, the city was still, you know, young in terms of great chefs. You know, all the great chefs at that time were, you know, most of them were French. But... he would be using ingredients like, you know, like blowfish, for instance. He'd be using blowfish. He would be serving, you know, live sea urchin and things like even lotus root and duck kidneys and, you know, and doing all sorts of things like that that a lot of people weren't, you know, weren't using at the time. Doing surf and turf with, I still remember doing like a surf and turf with, you know, like veal kidneys and swordfish
wow.
and, you know, doing...
way ahead of his time.
Yeah, really, really innovative things. And back in those days, you know, for a long time, people, you know, he was probably the most copied chef in the world for, you know, a number of years because he was, you know, he just pushed himself to be creative. And so that taught me a lot that you should stop at nothing to be creative. And you can always find inspiration from even something like a Twinkie. You could say, okay, Twinkies are so great. They're so popular. How can I take what that is and do something different with it? And then you can make, you know, a Verveine pastry cream and put it on the inside. And then you can make a matcha tea cake and have that be, you know, the base on the outside. And then you could inject it with a syringe and put in orange blossom syrup. And then you can – so it's like, you know, a thought process like that. You know, he just would stop at nothing. And it's something that still is in me every day.
And JG?
And John George, same thing with him, was he was way ahead of his time also in terms of using, you know, French Asian, you know, food, which are it's where I got a lot of my training from, is to use exotic ingredients and exotic spices and things like, again, he was using galanga and lemongrass before anybody knew what they were. I mean, this is when you couldn't find any of those ingredients and, you know, just using them in certain French techniques and making, you know, like galanga consomme and serving dumplings made with shrimp roe and shrimp and a little bit of, you know, foie gras and just putting on, you know, kaffir lime leaf or something like that in this bouillon that had more flavor than any soup that you can get on any street in Vietnam or in Chiang Mai or something like that. So things like that and just understanding how to mix both French and Asian cultures and it's still something and the exotic spices and black cardamom and things like that, which, again, are things that... still drive me today.
So do you just kind of, you know, go about your daily life and ideas just pop into your head or?
Oh, you never know. All the time. And, And that's why I love talking food with people, because that's what really gets that thought process going. And that's what's great with the teams and with Jamie and people like that, is that we can constantly talk about food. And that's why our menus are so big, because we're like, wow, let's make this. Let's go out. You know, like even today, it's freezing, and I'm going to go back and tell Jamie, oh, dude, we got to put on the blood sausage shepherd's pie on the menu tonight, you know, because it's like 20 below tonight, you know, let's put something bubbly and comforting and something like that on the menu. So,
okay. So last question before we wind it down, you have restaurants of every cuisine. It's amazing. Favorite cuisine to eat when you're off duty?
I would say, I mean, this changes a lot, but I love anything Asian, you know, Southeast Asian, Japanese, Chinese, and Mexican. So I love spicy food, and I love food with a lot of flavor. But I also, I'm not the youngest guy in the world anymore, and I like to try and eat a little healthier also. So that's what I love about, again, a lot of the Southeast Asian foods and things like that, is that you can eat, and Japanese, that you can eat food with a ton of flavor that's still, you know, where I don't have to go to the gym every day.
Cool. So with a little bit of time left, we're going to wind it down.
Wind down.
With Ken here in the studio. He loves chocolate, and it's not so easy to serve chocolate the way that it's supposed to be served, I guess. So
nobody pours it from up high with the spout in this country. I don't understand. Well, I'm sure probably Paul Greco does or something like that, but at a, you know, terroir. But you know, you have to get that effervescence going, and people definitely. You know, they don't take it as seriously as they should.
So you're definitely one of those chefs that actually you studied wine, and you actively, you know, not every, like, believe it or not every person who cooks actually, you know, studies wine so actively and sort of.
Well, I lived in San Francisco for a number of years, and I don't think anybody can cook in San Francisco and not be into wine.
Got
you know,
it.
Back in the day, and I know, you know, California wines can sometimes get a good rap, sometimes a bad rap, but at least you can meet the winemakers and understand the passion, and you know that only gets you going, because it's the same you know, it's the same type of thing as a chef. I mean, these people are growing something and trying to create something with, you know, it's their baby.
So when I interviewed to work at Terroir this summer, and I never ran into you on the Highline, I actually, you know, spieled chocolate as my favorite beverage. Why do you love it?
Well, anything Basque I love, but it just brings back memories of, you know, of hanging out in all the, you know, tapas bars and pincho bars and San Sebastian, and I just love anything that's a little bit different, and there's the showmanship of how they pour it. It has.
Can you describe it for, you know, this is a fairly specific wine.
Okay, so it's pretty much they'll put on a pouring spout on a wine, which you never see, and then they'll start it low, and it's almost like drinking the Peron. They'll start it low and then lift it up high, and pretty much let it stream out into the cup, you know, the canna or whatever, or the glass that they use, and it has a slight effervescence for a still wine. And it just brings out, again, all the nuances, all the mineral nuances. And it's just really crisp and refreshing. And, again, it's from an area that is not quite under people's radar, but it has almost a cult following. And I just can never drink enough chocolate, especially during the summer, again, with the chocolate rosés and things like that as well.
You've tried to train your staff.
We do. I mean, some people pour it properly, but it's hard. I mean, you have to have good aim. Otherwise, you're pouring it all over the table. You're pouring it all over people. It's a little trickier, and it takes a lot of practice. That's why I'd be curious to see how the guys at, like, Pearl and Ash, or how Paul, you know, handle it, because those guys are experts at those type of challenges.
Did you participate a whole lot in the creation of the wine list at Toro NYC?
It's funny, Toro Boston I did way back in the beginning, you know, about 8 years ago, but Caitlin is so great, and we talked wine, you know, numerous times before we hired her, and we were definitely on the same page, and once we saw how great she was, we're like, okay, this baby is yours, we'll concentrate on dealing with the 5 billion other things to deal with the opening of
the 5 billion items on the menu. Thank you so much, Ken, for joining me.
My pleasure, Leti. Thank you.
I'll come in for the poron and the fantastic
course. And don't forget those hot friends of yours, too.
Thanks so much for listening. Next week, we'll have on Chris Cannon, restaurateur, who has just launched Alonda, Japanese Venetian restaurant, to great anticipation and early praise, and it's totally delicious. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Fancy restaurant records.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.